Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 261 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in this podcast, I'll be finishing up our dermatology review for the USMLE exams, right? This will be helpful to representing step one, step two, step three. And remember, there's three parts. I've done part one of three, I've done part two of three, right? This will be part three of three. The thing is, basically, I need this, my goal making this podcast is to make it as comprehensive as possible, right? So basically, I feel like if you know these three podcasts, there'll be very few derm questions you cannot answer, right? Because I feel like I've been pretty exhaustive in covering most of the derm pathologies and essentially describing them to you in the ways they will test them on exams, right? And today, what I'll be doing is I'll spend a lot of time talking about associations that I feel like will be really helpful. Because sometimes one thing your friends at the NBME love to do is they love to give you like dermatologic manifestations of other kinds of disease, right? So we'll kind of hit those pretty hard today, right? So that you feel comfortable. And again, just as a reminder, if you're taking your exam, like your complex level two or your step two CK exam anytime soon, right? I do have two courses next week that I think will be helpful, right? I call it like the trifecta in a sense, right? It's like September 21st. We have a 2.5 hour test taking strategies course specifically for the MBMEs. I'll bring like 20 questions that we'll work on, right? Very carefully written questions. Again, I have a ton of experience writing MBME style questions. We'll use those review test taking strategies in real time, right? And then on Tuesday, the 22nd, and Wednesday, the 23rd, from noon to 5 p.m. Pacific time, we'll cover like content from peds, surgery, OB-GYN, IM, psych, and neuro in an integrated format over 10 hours, right? So if you're interested in any of those things, the testing and strategies course is from 2 to 4:30 p.m. Pacific on Monday. And then the course, the Step 2 CK comprehensive course is on Tuesday and Wednesday, right? So the September the 22nd and 23rd from noon to 5 p.m. Pacific on both days. Okay. So let's jump right into things, right? So I remember the last time we had this derm podcast, right? You know, I kind of talked about how, again, penicillin allergies are pretty common, right? In fact, if there's any drug allergy, right, that they ask on your exams, right? If they ask, oh, which of the following agents is the most likely cause of blah, 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 blah allergy, and they give you a bunch of drugs that the patient is taking, pick the penicillin, right? Now, the thing is, again, if you want to check a person for a penicillin allergy, right, again, don't forget, they'll try to trick you into picking like an ELISA test, or they'll try to trick you into picking like a RAST, like a radioallergosorbent something assays, like RAST, right? Don't pick any of those, right? To diagnose penicillin allergies, you know, go ahead and pick a skin test, right? Pick skin testing and you'll be in good shape, right? And again, for the most part, if a person has like a reaction to penicillin, right, that doesn't mean that they cannot take a cephalosporin, doesn't mean they cannot take like a carbapenem, right? But there's an exception to that rule. If you notice a person has had an anaphylactic reaction to penicillin, then you cannot give any other penicillin-containing agent, right? You cannot give anything like a carbapenem, right? So those drugs like imipenem, meropenem, ertapenem, doripenem, right? You cannot give any of those drugs. And you also cannot give any of your cephalosporins, right? You should know what those are at this point, right? Like your cefazolin, your ceftriaxone, your cefepime, your ceftazidine, your cefdinir and things like that. You cannot give any of those drugs, right? So if a person has had an anaphylactic reaction to penicillin, again, please do not give them, and this is actually also real, right? For like, you know, like NBME exams and also for the real world, do not give those people a penicillin containing agent anymore, right? Remember aztreonam, this is one of those unique ways they can test aztreonam on an exam. Aztreonam, right, it kind of works like a penicillin. It's a cell wall inhibitor, but it doesn't have that beta-lactam chain, right? It's a monobactam. So because it's a monobactam, you don't have any cross-reactivity like you have with the other penicillins. Again, that's a high yield way they can bring step one stuff to step two CK, right? Again, remember, the NBME in recent times, over the last few weeks to months, they've been bringing in a decent number of step one related things to step two CK, right? So again, just something to keep at the back of your mind on NBME exams, right? And then I also remember the last time we spoke, I'm just trying to kind of like maintain my bearings here. We also did talk about like the Jarisch-Hexheimer reaction, right? So they will give you a question about a person that's being treated for some spirochete-based infection, right? So it can be leptospirosis, it can be Lyme disease caused by Borrelia burgdorferi, right? It can be syphilis, right? Treponema pallidum, right? And they'll tell you that, oh, this person started this therapy. And it's not something that, oh, they've been on this therapy for 2 weeks. No. The Jarisch-Hexheimer reaction is an acute reaction, right? It's an acute reaction. It'll be something that happens like a couple hours, like two, three, four, five, six hours after a person just started a penicillin, right? And they notice that the person has like, you know, they have like joint pain, they have like a rash, they're like hypotensive. If you see that, think about the Jarisch-Hexheimer reaction. For the most part, it's just supportive care. Give them fluids. Don't stop the antibiotics. They will put an answer on your exam that involves stopping those antibiotics. Don't do it, right? And one thing they love to do is asking about the mechanism behind the Jarisch-Hexheimer reaction. It's just basically, as you're killing those spirochetes, they're releasing endotoxin into the bloodstream, right? And that endotoxin, right, is basically causing these systemic symptoms, right? So again, keep that at the back of your mind as you go through these exam questions, right? And then what if they give you a question about a person that, you know, recently started like a drug regimen for acne, right? And then they tell you that, man, this person, like, you know, he lives in California or whatever, like some state that has a ton of like beaches, not like a beach, B-E-A-C-H. Just want to clarify that before people start having their minds are running wild. Essentially, right, if you notice, right, like they give you a question like that, right, and you notice that, oh, you're like, man, this person studied an acne regimen. They may tell you that the person recently studied an oral regimen for acne, right? And then this person went to the beach, and then this person has been having like really bad extensive sunburns, even if the person has been using like what is this thing that used to protect people from sunburns? I've never used it before. Sunblock, like sunscreen. Yes, sunscreen. And again, remember, sunscreen, if you're less than 6 months old, shouldn't be giving sunscreen to a kid, right? That's a terrible idea. Okay, but back to this, right? So if you see a person having that kind of stuff, right, you want to think about a tetracycline allergy, right? Like, not an allergy. Think of it more as like the tetracycline photosensitivity, right? Remember, there are some drugs on MDMA exams that cause photosensitivity, right? So the classic mnemonic you probably remember learning from back in the days, the term SAT for photo, right? So like the S stands for sulfonamides, right? So like pyrimethamine sulfadiazine, trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole, right? Sulfasalazine, so they can make that a question about a person being treated for ulcerative colitis or Crohn's, right? And then the A stands for amiodarone, right? So if they give you again a question about a person that recently studied some kind of antiarrhythmic, and then the person has been getting a lot of sunburns, right? Think about amiodarone photosensitivity, right? And then the T is for tetracycline, right? Classically, again, a tetracycline will be a person taking the tetracycline, then they're getting all the sunburns, right? And again, what do we use tetracyclines for? It can be a Lyme disease question, right? It can be a question about a person that has Rocky Mountain spotted fever. It can be a question about a person that's being treated for acne. Again, remember, you can use an oral tetracycline as one of the treatment regimens for acne, right? And then don't forget that sulfonamides, right? Especially like TMPSMX, pyrimethamine sulfadiazine, right? Again, they can cause that photosensitivity. But one key thing that I think is very critical here is people that have this sulfonamide skin problems, right? They can actually get it, this like skin rash, days after they started the drug, or they can get it years after they've been on the drug, right? So don't be afraid if you see MDME questions where you see a person like, you know, has been having like this rash, right? And they've been on like a sulfonamide for like a year, right? So they can give you like a question about a person that has like pneumocystis jervetzi, right? Or a person that's on chronic steroid therapy, you know, that is taking TMPSMX, right? As prophylaxis against pneumocystis jervetzi, right? Whenever you see stuff like that, right? Again, keep that at the back of your mind with these sulfonamides, right? And then what if they give you a question about a person that, you know, comes in with like pyelonephritis and the person is giving like IV Cipro? And then this person, you know, has like flushing on the body, right? Like really hypotensive, having all these muscle aches and pains. If you see that, I hope you're thinking about Redman syndrome, right? So the thing is, your friends at the MBMEs, they're becoming very clever, right? So they know that every human being, again, that has the job description med student probably remembers from step one vaguely that Redman syndrome is caused by vancomycin. Do not forget that actually ciprofloxacin also has the ability to cause Redman syndrome on MDMA exams. Again, that's a floridly high yield thing to know for exams, right? It's a floridly high yield thing to know for exams, right? And then what if they give you a question on a test and it's about like a patient and they tell you that, oh, this patient recently started like some kind of antibiotic or something, right? And then they tell you that, you know, a few days later, the patient started noticing like these like round oval, like discrete lesions, like on the torso, on the buttocks, on the back and stuff like that, right? And they're trying to get you to pick an answer as to like, what in the world is this? If you see that, I want you to think about some kind of drug eruption, right? They call these things usually on MBM exams, like a fixed drug eruption, right? Like a fixed drug eruption, right? And then what if they give you a question about like a college student, she's 21 years old, right? And you know, they tell you that, you know, she had like pharyngitis, like you know, she had like throat pain, sore throat like 3 days ago. And then she went to the student clinic. She was given a prescription for ampicillin, right? Because remember, yes, ampicillin is classically IV, but there's actually oral formulations of ampicillin, right? And then they tell you that, oh, she develops like this diffuse rash all over her skin, right? After taking the ampicillin for 2 days. If you see that, right, I would encourage you to think about mono, right? So this person has mono from EBV. Remember, EBV, if you get like a penicillin-based product, it can actually cause a big, big, big rash in a person that has mono, okay? Because that pharyngitis was basically misdiagnosed as like some like regular bacterial pharyngitis when it was actually an EBV infection that this patient had. Okay, now what if they give you a question about a patient, right? And they tell you that, oh, this patient, you know, for the past 2 days, right, has, you know, maybe was recently started on like some antibiotic, right? Or maybe not an antibiotic. The person, they just tell you that, oh, this person has been having like these painful like erosions like on the oral mucosa, right? And then they tell you that you see like this purulent bully and vesicles on the skin, right? And they tell you that, oh, when you sweep, when you apply like sliding pressure, right, like when you slide your hand over the patient's skin, that you notice like a lot of purulence, right, like purulent discharge and stuff. If you see that, right, again, think about pemphigus vulgaris, right? Think about pemphigus vulgaris. Remember, it has the positive Nikolsky sign, right? And the thing is, pemphigus vulgaris, right? So what is the classic distribution of areas it affects on exams, right? Tends to affect like the trunk, right? The person's like extremities, right? Especially like their more proximal extremities, like their arms, right? Or their thighs. And it also definitely affects the oral mucosa on NBM exams, right? Again, don't forget that for pemphigus vulgaris, right? These people will have a positive Nikolsky sign, right? And to make the diagnosis, again, they love to ask about the diagnostic test on exams. You want to do direct immunofluorescence, right? You want to pick the answer that says to do direct immunofluorescence. And you notice that there's IgG deposited between the cells, right? So you see, like they may tell you, they may even ask you a question and say, which of the following is the most likely finding on direct immunofluorescence, right? So you'll be reading the question. I'm sure you've had this experience many times before. You're reading a question and you're like, oh, I know what this is. And then they tell you what it is in the question. And you're like, right? And then as you keep reading, right, they now ask you something completely bizarre. That's like one classic go-to move for the newer MBM exams, right? So, you know, they'll tell you which of the following is most likely finding on direct immunofluorescence, right? You want to think about intercellular deposition of IgG, right? So if you see that, I want you to think about pemphigus vulgaris, right? Contrast this with bullous pemphigoid, right? In bullous pemphigoid, remember, these people have like tense blisters, right? Tense blisters. So the reason they're tense is because the Nikolsky sign is negative, right? And again, the diagnosis is made the exact same way, right? The exact same way, right? You perform direct immunofluorescence, right? And you'll find like this linear IgG pattern, but it will not be between the cells. It will be in the basement membrane, right? So you find the linear pattern, right? So again, remember, linear deposition of IgG in the basement membrane, you can find it in two disorders on your test. You can find it in bullous pemphigoid, right? But it'll be in the skin, obviously, right? And you can find it in good pasture syndrome, but that'll obviously either be in the kidneys or in the lungs, right? In the kidneys or in the lungs. That'll be a nephritic syndrome presentation, right? Remember, that's a type 2 hypersensitivity reaction. And really, pemphigus vulgaris, because again, they love to occasionally bring in immunology on these new NBM exams. Pemphigus vulgaris and bullous pemphigoid, I will consider those to be type 2 hypersensitivity reactions on your test. Okay, type 2 hypersensitivity reactions on your test. Okay, so again, just key critical things you want to keep at the back of your mind as you take these exams, right? And really, for the most part, the way you treat pemphigus or bullous pemphigoid, right? It's pretty easy, right? Go ahead and give those people oral steroids. Oral steroids are the treatment of choice. But if you notice that the person is not getting better, right? Or the oral glucocorticoids are not cutting it, then your next step in management for these people is plasmapheresis, right? Plasmapheresis is the second line treatment, right? It's the second line treatment for bullous pemphigoid or pemphigus vulgaris, right? And one thing they can also say, they can give you these questions on exams where they will say like, oh, you know, they tell you a person that has like bullous pemphigoid or pemphigus vulgaris. And then they'll say, in addition, again, one of these evil ways, let's not call it evil, but one of these unique ways they can test, again, like weird stuff with these diseases, they can say, oh, in addition to steroid therapy, right? So they're already telling you, we're going to give steroids, right? That's a settled thing, right? So you're like, oh man, I thought this question would be asking me to pick steroids. No, right? So they may say, oh, in addition to steroid therapy, which of the following medications can be added to reduce morbidity or hasten symptom resolution or whatever? If you see stuff like that, don't forget Dapsone, right? Don't forget Dapsone. And I may be making a mistake here. So quick question here, right? So, sorry, not Dapsone. Plasmapheresis, right? So if, again, if you want to hasten symptom resolution, right, in a person that has like bullous pemphigoid or pemphigus vulgaris, or again, so that's one way they can test that, or they can test it in the context of, oh, this person has been given steroids, this person having a, like a slow response to therapy or no response, right? In those circumstances, consider putting that person on, consider placing that person on plasmapheresis, right? On plasmapheresis. Remember, plasmapheresis is also what we use to treat like a bunch of neurologic issues, right? Like we can use it to treat like a Guillain-Barré syndrome, for example, right? And then remember, if they give you a question about a person that, you know, has like iron deficiency anemia, right? And they also tell you that this person has like these like very itchy, right? Very pruritic like vesicles, like on their elbows, right? Their knees, their back, their buttocks, right? Like basically a lot of extensor surfaces, right? If you see that, right, and the person has like a low weight or something like that, think about celiac disease, right? This person has dermatitis herpetiformis, right? This person has dermatitis herpetiformis. And the thing is dermatitis herpetiformis, right? Like if they're asking you for the first step in management, right, your first step in management is actually to exclude gluten from the diet. Usually that's great, and that's usually good enough to fix the problem, right? But if you don't see that as an answer choice, the second line treatment is Dapsone, right? Dapsone is the drug of choice for treating dermatitis herpetiformis on MBME exams, right? And then what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient is an IV drug user, right? And then they tell you that, oh, that this IV drug user on the back of his hands, this IV drug user has like these, like, again, like these vesicles, bullae, right? And they tell you that, oh, that, you know, that he noticed more vesicles and more bullae after he hit his hand on a table or something, like, you know, something super minor that shouldn't cause like that kind of profound skin reaction. Again, especially on the back of the hands, right? If you see stuff like that, I would really, 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 really hope that you're thinking about porphyria cutanea tarda, right? I would really hope you're thinking about porphyria cutanea tarda. And again, one way the MBME can go after this is they can see which of the following is the biggest risk factor, right, for porphyria cutanea tarda. You want to pick Hep C, right? About 50% of people that have PCT, right, which is porphyria cutanea tarda, right, they tend to have Hep C infection. In fact, they can ask, oh, in addition to treatment, what is the next best step in management? Go ahead and test that person for Hep C, right? So go ahead and do like a HCV PCR or something like that, right? Or look for the HCV antibodies in the patient's serum, right? And again, remember those people, because it's a heme synthesis disorder, if you take urine from those folks, right, and put it on the Wood's lamp, right, their urine will kind of give off like this dark orange color, right? Or give us this dark orange color, right? And again, if you do direct immunofluorescence on these folks, right, again, you may see like all these immunoglobulins, right, all this IgG, it's kind of deposited around like the capillaries that line the dermis, right, and also around the basement membrane, right? So again, look at the context, right? Again, there are many different ways they can go with derm, because they know that most people just kind of give up on derm, so they don't even bother studying it, right? The thing is, derm is just one of those things where if you know, you can potentially get like 10 questions right, right? And again, that can be the difference between getting in the 230s and getting in the 240s on your exam, right? So it's just one of those things I will encourage you to not ignore, essentially, on exams, right? Now, this dermatitis herpetiformis that I talked about earlier, right? So what if they tell you that, oh, a person has dermatitis herpetiformis, you know, he started on Dapsone therapy, and then the person starts having like hematuria, has an indirect hyperbilirubinemia. If you see that, I will hope you are, and it will be a guy. It's not going to be a woman. It's going to be a guy. If you see this, what should you be thinking about? I would really, 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 really hope that you're thinking about G6PD deficiency, right? Again, the MBME, they are all about integration, 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 right? Integration, integration, integration. That's the thing. Like, I feel like as we go along later in the year, like early next year, right, you'll start seeing a somewhat different focus with some of the courses I'll be offering, right? The courses I currently offer like really tackle like the context of the MBMEs, especially like the testing and strategies course. But really the MBME, they are getting very creative in the way they're writing questions, right? So again, try to not just learn something like one-dimensional, try to learn things in a multi-dimensional fashion. I feel like that's a very helpful thing to do in this day and age on MBME exams. And it's also a good way to think about patients as you're treating them. Okay, right? So remember G6PD deficiency, because again, dapsone, right? Dapsone is a very powerful agent, right? It's a powerful oxidizing agent, right? So if a person has G6PD deficiency, they can't deal with oxidative stress. They're going to get in trouble, right? And again, dapsone is not only used just for G6PD deficient, I mean, for dermatitis and pyriformis on NBMEs. Remember, you can also use it to treat leprosy, right? On a test, right? So they can make this a leprosy question in a person that's having these exact same, like, again, hematuria, indirect hyperbilirubinemia, and all that stuff, right? And again, remember, to treat leprosy, you give the person a triple regimen, right? I almost think of this as like triple therapy. It's a combination of dapsone, rifampin, and clofazimine, right? Dapsone, rifampin, and clofazimine for leprosy. And then another thing you can use dapsone for on NBME exams is also as PCP prophylaxis, right? But that's a much rarer presentation on exams, right? Usually you do TMPSMX for PCP prophylaxis on exams, right? And then what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that, oh, this patient, she has like these vesicles on her lip, or you may see vesicles like on her genitals, right? Or it can also be a guy. And then they'll tell you that this person has had these things like many times. Or you also notice that, oh, this person also has like these like bullseye lesions. Multiple, notice I'm not saying one, multiple bullseye lesions, right? Multiple bullseye lesions like on the skin, right? If you see that, I would really, really hope you're thinking about erythema multiforme, right? I would really hope you're thinking about erythema multiforme. And one thing, your friends at the NBME love to do, they can ask, again, they'll give you all these risk factors that the patient has. And then they'll say, which of the following is the biggest risk factor in this patient for erythema multiforme? The biggest risk factor for EM on exams is actually having like a lot of HSV infections, especially when you have it on a recurrent basis, right? So whenever you see a person having recurring HSV infections, that's actually the biggest risk factor for erythema multiforme. Although this can also be caused by drugs, right? Again, the classic culprits, right? Sulfonamides, penicillins, phenytoin, right? Those things love to cause a lot of problems, right? So how do you treat erythema multiforme? Easy, right? Stop the drug, right? If you see an answer choice that says stop the drug, go ahead and stop the drug, right? Go ahead and stop the drug, right? And then, you know, just supportive care, fluids, make sure you're fixing the electrolyte problems. That's pretty much it, right? But if they give you this specific scenario of a person that has erythema multiforme, and this person is getting like recurrent HSV infections, recurrent infection, right? Then, and they say, oh, which of the following is the best long-term management for this person's disorder, right? On exams, you want to pick like the person taking like suppressive acyclovir, right? So they'll be taking acyclovir like on a regular basis. Just like, oh, you know, like if a person has like herpes, right? And they're like, oh, I want suppressive therapy, they can take acyclovir like all the time, right? Kind of like the same thing. If a person is having like recurring erythema multiforme, usually it'll be like kind of mild, right? For these people, again, for long-term, notice what I said, for long-term management, right? Go ahead and put these people on like suppressive acyclovir. But again, if a person has erythema multiforme, let's say it's like acute presentation, whatever, acyclovir is not going to be the right answer. Again, that's why I said long-term management. The acute management of erythema multiforme is to stop the drug that's causing problems. If they are not on any drug that's causing the problem, just supportive care, right? But long-term management, a person that you're like, man, this person keeps getting HSV, right? Go ahead and put them on a daily like acyclovir, okay? So hopefully that's something you feel confident with, right? And then in this, I guess, circle of dermatology, if we're talking about erythema multiforme, it probably makes sense for us to talk about like SJS and TEN, right? Stevens-Johnson syndrome, toxic epidermal necrolysis. Again, basically these people's skin slough off, right? They can show you like a person's hand and you see like it's almost like their skin of their hand is like a covering right over that, right? So the thing is, essentially, the way these conditions present is you'll just see a person with like flu-like symptoms. They'll have like myalgias, fevers, basically feeling like crap, right? And then after that, they'll now start having like big-time skin eruption, right? And again, the percentage of the skin that's affected tells you exactly what you're dealing with. If it's less than 10% of the skin that's affected, that's Stevens-Johnson syndrome, right? But if it's more than 30% of the skin that's affected, right, that's toxic epidermal necrolysis, right? And it's easy to remember, right? Toxic. If something is toxic, right, it means it's super bad, right? It's super bad, right? So think about that, right? And then if you're between 10 to 30%, because I know some of you may be like, okay, Divine, what's this black hole that exists between 10 to 30%? That's just a combination name. It's called like SJSTEN, right? SJSTEN, right? So again, something to keep at the back of your mind on exams. And these people, again, so they'll have the flu-like symptoms. And then again, a few days, 2 weeks afterwards, right? You have like this big eruption on their skin, right? And then you'll notice that they'll have like a ton of skin pain. And these people, it's very high yield to know. They'll have a lot of vesicles, bulle, right? And then they'll also have a positive Nikolsky sign. The Nikolsky sign is absolutely positive in SJS and TEN on exams, right? In SJS and TEN on exams. And again, your next step on exams is to go ahead and stop the drug. That's always the first thing you do. Stop the drug. Stop the drug that's causing all these problems, right? But then, if the person has a particularly severe presentation, especially TEN, this is something that's usually done with people that have toxic epidermonecrolysis, you need to actually get those people to like a burn unit, right? Like a hospital that has like a special burn unit, or you can get them to an ICU. These are not patients you take care of on the floor, right? Again, just something to keep in mind on exams. And then, so let's kind of bust through some associations here, right? So what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that, oh, this patient has a, you know, history of like, you know, it's an African-American female and she has like these painful lesions on her lower extremities. They're round, they're tender and all that stuff, right? If you see that, I'd hope you're thinking about erythema nodosum, right? That's pretty easy. Remember, erythema nodosum is associated with sarcoidosis on exams, is associated with coccidiomycosis on exams, and it's also associated with like inflammatory bowel disease, right? So like ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease, right? And then what if they give you a question about, again, this same African-American female, right? And they tell you that, you know, she has like these like purple-colored lesions, right? You know, around her nose, around her eyes, like in a Miller-style distribution, right? Like around the cheeks. If you see that, right, you notice this thing is sort of kind of like a lupus-like presentation. You're like, man, this person's got sarcoid. This person's having like this purple rash, right? Around the eyes, around the nose, around the cheeks. If you see that, right, think about something called lupus pernio, right? Lupus pernio, it's a finding that it's a classic dermatologic finding usually on the face in a person that has a history of sarcoidosis, right? Now, what if they give you a question about a patient, right? And they tell you that, oh, this patient, you know, is like a 23-year-old male, has a history of like chronic bloody diarrhea, right? He has had this for like 3 to 5 months, right? He has lost like a ton of weight in that period. And then they tell you that he has like this painful ulcer that's very exudative, right? You're seeing like a lot of like discharge from the ulcer, right? And he has like raised edges, a big ulcer, right? And you notice that it's on his like lower extremities. If you see that, I would really, really hope that you're thinking about pyoderma gangrenosum, right? Pyoderma gangrenosum. Remember, that's something that, again, you classically find in people that have inflammatory bowel disease. And then, what if they give you a question about a patient? They tell you that, oh, this patient is currently being treated. This patient has like a history of like end-stage renal disease, right? And the person is being treated, you know, for like a spinal epidural abscess that was diagnosed by MRI like 2 days ago, right? And then they ask you, like, they tell you that over the last like 12 hours, this patient has been having this like induration of the skin. The skin is very thick, right? And they tell you that this person's skin is very tight, right? If you see stuff like this, right, then you want to think about nephrogenic systemic fibrosis, right? NSF. Right. Remember, that's caused by gadolinium, right? So this person got like spinal imaging. If you're getting spinal imaging, usually, right, you're going to get some kind of gad, right? You're going to get gadolinium, right? And then you're going to get in trouble, right? And then, again, if they ask, which of the following factors in this patient's medical history is the most likely predisposing condition, right? Or most likely predisposing factor to this patient's presentation? I want you to think about having a history of end-stage renal disease, right? Having a history of end-stage renal disease is one of the biggest risk factors for getting NSF, right? And again, these people will get it in the context, right? They'll get it in the context of getting gadolinium, right? For like MRI imaging. And there's really not much you can do for that, unfortunately. Okay, now what if they give you a question about, again, let's maybe talk about these kidney people, right? What if they give you a question about a person, you know, has a history of like end-stage renal disease, and then they tell you that this person has like these really painful like nodules, like under the skin, right? Really painful nodules under the skin. And they tell you that, oh, they kind of look like red, or they may tell you that they look brown. If you see that, do you know what you should be thinking about? I would really, really hope you're thinking about calciphylaxis, right? I would really, really hope you're thinking about calciphylaxis. Remember, people that have end-stage renal disease, they tend to have like a crap ton of phosphate, right? So because they have a lot of phosphates, they're not able to maintain like an appropriate solubility product. If you remember from like college general chemistry, like you probably remember learning about KSP, right? But don't worry, we're not doing college chemistry here today, right? So they essentially will have like, they have like an inappropriate solubility product for calcium and phosphate, right? So whenever they have that, right, that will begin to precipitate in their skin, right? And then, because it's calcium, right, again, it can change color pretty easily, right? So you'll be like a red or a brown coloration, like painful nodules under the skin, end-stage renal disease patient, I want you to think about calciphylaxis on an MBM exam, right? And then again, if they give you a question about a person, again, IV drug user, and then they tell you that, oh, over the last 3 days, this person has had like this big, like just breakout, right, of like what is like, you know, like these oily lesions on the skin, on the head, everywhere, like basically like seborrheic dermatitis that just breaks out like suddenly, right, like this big breakout of seborrheic dermatitis on the skin in an IV drug user, right? This IV drug user needs to be, and they ask you for your next step in management on the test. Go ahead and screen that person for HIV, right? The person very likely has a HIV, right? The person very likely has a HIV. And then, again, another skin finding, right? If they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that, oh, this patient, you know, recently had like some kind of cardiac catheterization, right? Or this patient has like a recently diagnosed vasculitis. And then they tell you that, oh, this person has like these like net-like lesions on the extremities. Think about livedo reticularis, right? Again, they love livedo reticularis on these exams. If you see livedo reticularis, think about like, again, like this aortic atherombolic disease that people get after getting like a recent cardiac cath, right? Or think about it in a person that has like some kind of vasculitis, okay? Think about it in a person that has some kind of a vasculitis, right? And then if they give you a question about a person, and you know, they tell you that this person has like these velvety lesions, right? Like on, you know, like flexor surfaces, right? Like the neck, under the breast, stuff like that, right? You want to think about insulin resistance, right? Person may have like diabetes. But don't forget, this stuff is also associated with like a person having like some kind of GI malignancy. It can be like a gastric cancer, something like that, right? So that's acanthosis nigricans. If you see it in an OB-GYN question, that's a woman that has PCOS pretty much, right? So again, don't get that stuff wrong, right? And then, you know, don't forget how, you know, if a person has these genetic syndromes, like these familial hyperlipidemias, right? Those people tend to have like xanthomas, like on the eyes, especially like the eyelid. They can have it like around their ankles, right? Like their soles of their feet, stuff like that. If you see that, right? Think about like xanthomas, right? Xanthomas, xanthelasmas, those tend to be associated with these familial dyslipidemias, right? And then if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient, right, has been having like a lot of like proximal muscle pain and also proximal muscle weakness, right? And then you notice they give you like a picture of the person's hands and you're like, man, this person's hands look like concrete, right? It's like very like fissured, right? Looks very thick. Just terrible hands, right? Like kind of looks like a person that has been walking, you know, like mechanics, right? How their hands look literally, right? Like if they worked on cars for a long time, like for many years, you see their hands just look just very nasty. If you see stuff like that, right? Think about mechanics hands, right? Remember, that's a classic finding in people that have these myopathies, right? Like these autoimmune myopathies, like polymyositis or dermatomyositis, right? So again, just something to keep at the back of your mind on exams, right? And then don't forget, right, if you see, again, I'm just at this point just kind of steamrolling through some of these classic like systemic disorders, right, that have like dermatological manifestations, right? So if, for example, you see a question about a person, right, and they tell you, you know, this person has like you know, hemoglobin of like 7, and this person's creatinine has been rising progressively over the last like 1 year, right, and this person has been getting like, has had like 3 episodes of like pneumococcal pneumonia, right? And then you notice that this person has like a large tongue, right? And they tell you that, oh, this person has sallow. This is like a term that MBMs love these days, sallow, right? So it's a person's skin that looks like candle wax, right? Sallow is spelled S-A-L-L-O-W, right? Sallow skin, right? If you see that, right, I want you to think about like multiple myeloma, right? Because remember, multiple myeloma can present as amyloidosis on a test, right? And people that have amyloid, they tend to get like big tongues, they can get like a restrictive cardiomyopathy, right? They can get amyloid kidney disease and stuff like that, right? So keep that at the back of your mind on exams, right? And then if a person has like, again, like crusted lesions around the nipple, right? Kind of looks like eczema, right? If you see eczema breast, right, again, I would really hope you're thinking about like Paget's disease of the nipple. Remember, those people need like mammogram and a corneal biopsy, right? Because many times people that have Paget's disease of the breast, they tend to have like underlying infiltrating a ductal carcinoma, right? And then what if they give you a question about a person, right? And again, they tell you that this person has like a lot of eczema, right? And it's maybe like a middle-aged person, has a lot of eczema like under the feet, right? On the elbows, right? Or like the underside of the knees, right? And they tell you that this person has been like losing weight and has like new onset diabetes. If you see that, I would really, really hope you're thinking about a glaucoma, right? Remember, again, they're not going to say a patient presents with diabetes and necrolytic migratory erythema. No, they're not going to do that on a test, right? That's not prudent, right? You shouldn't be going into your exam expecting those kinds of things, right? So if you see stuff like that, think about a glaucoma. If you see a person that has like new onset diabetes and eczema, especially like on flexural surfaces, right? I want you to think about glaucoma on MBME exams, right? And what if they give you a question about a patient? You know, they tell you this patient has a history of HIV, right? And you know, this person went swimming recently, and this person, you know, had like this painless lesion that, you know, for the most part, you know, kind of started like on his like arms or trunk or whatever, but it has quickly become like very necrotic, right? And it has become painless, right? So like it's, you know, painless, like necrotic and all that stuff. The person that just recently like went swimming in the beach or a community pool or whatever, right? And this person has like HIV, and let's say the person has like a CD4 count of like 100, you know, telling you that, you know, this person's immune system is not very great. If you see that, I want you to think about ecthema gangrenosum, right? I really want you to think about ecthema gangrenosum, right? I want you to think about ecthema gangrenosum. And one of these weird, unique things they may do to you on an MBM exam, right, is they may give you a question about a person, right? And they'll tell you again, this person has like, again, like this chronic history of bloody diarrhea, right? That, you know, the person has never seen a physician for, right? And again, the person has like this necrotic lesion on the lower extremities that's very exudative, right? Hurts a lot, right? Has like these raised edges, right? Again, think about pyoderma gangrenosum, right? And you may ask, what's your next best step in management for this patient, right? Go ahead and pick an answer choice that says to do a colonoscopy, right? Because again, you want to diagnose the inflammatory bowel disease that he have. Usually in this case, it's going to be Crohn's. It's going to be Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis. I'll say usually it's ulcerative colitis that tends to have that association on exams, right? So again, hopefully you found this Durham podcast to be helpful. Please subscribe to the YouTube channel. Again, I promise I'll start making more videos actually in the very near future. I've just been super, super busy, right? So subscribe to the YouTube channel. It's called Divine Intervention, you know, USMLE podcasts and videos. That's where I have all the videos that I have, like for all the shelf exams. Although you will also find links to them on the website along with the slides. The slides are on the actual website. And again, I have a WordPress website, you know, divineinterventionpodcast.com. And then these podcasts are on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, and on Google Play. So please subscribe. That's always helpful and very much appreciated. And, you know, leave any comments or feedback, stuff like that, right? And then my life lesson for today, right? So what's my life lesson for today? My life lesson for today is about the importance of being humble, right? So what do I mean by that, right? Again, I'm not using this to crap on another team, like an NBA team. But I feel like until you've gotten the victory on something, even after you've gotten the victory, still remain humble, right? Because the thing is, it's better, right, to not have bragged, right, or trash talked other people, right, and you lose, right, than to have bragged, trash talked other people, and then you lose and lose in big fashion, right? So I'll give you the classic example of the Clippers, right? So if you're a basketball person, right, like if you watch the NBA, right, you probably remember like the Los Angeles Clippers, right? So, you know, these people at the very beginning of the season, right, they were like, they're going to win the championship. You know, they got Kawhi Leonard, sold the farm to get Paul George, right? And these were people that they were like, yeah, we're going to win this season. I mean, like, it was like clear as day, like every sports analyst known to man said, these people are going to win, right? And then, you know, these people, they barely sneak through the first round of the playoffs, right? And then now they got to the second round, right? And, you know, at the end of, they were up 3-1, you know, they won out of the first four games, they won the first three, right? And then game five, they lost, right? And then, you know, one of the stars on the team, you know, kept saying, oh, we should have put them away. We're in the driver's seat. We're doing this. We're doing that, right? Like, that's not the right thing to do. Like, really, I'm telling you this. Like, you can basically remove a lot of shame from your life if you're humble, right? This team proceeded to lose game five, game six, game seven, and they got knocked out in the second round. Can you imagine that, right? So, like, don't brag, right? There are other players on the team that said, oh, the next 5 years are ours, right? But these people have not won a lick of a championship. They've not even gone into the NBA finals. I think in the entire franchise history, right? Like 50 years, something like some ridiculous number, right? So again, don't be proud, don't boast, right? It's better, even if you're succeeding, keep mum about it, keep quiet about it, because whether you like it or not, I'll tell you this right now, it's not everybody that is happy that you are succeeding. And those same people that are propping you up when you are succeeding, they'll be the exact same people that will pull you down. Is it not the same media? It's the same. That's why, like, I'm very distrustful of praise from people, right? Or I'm not, you know, some people praise you genuinely. They're like, man, you're doing good work. Thank you, blah, 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 right? But the thing is, those same people that are propping you up with their mouths, they're the same people that will push you into the ground with their mouths as well. It's not the same media that was propping up these people, oh, best team in the West, this. They were the same people that absolutely just crucified these people. I mean, go on Reddit, go on YouTube, go on Twitter, right? News cycles, right? These people were absolutely eviscerated, right? The Clippers, right? Like, it's so much shame. But I feel like if they were not being so proud, if they had kind of like kept, it's better to almost like in your speech, under promise, but over deliver. Right. So like, let's say, for example, in their speech, they were like, oh, you know, we absolutely respect this Denver team. You know, they are doing a very good job. I mean, like, you know, we're also figuring out this whole basketball thing. You know, this is our first season together as a team or whatever. Right. And if they didn't put themselves on such a big pedestal from the beginning. Right. When they lost, then it's like they'll have a fall because people will still trash them on account of that. Right. Because I mean, you have stars. Right. But the fall would have been softer, right? Basically, think about if a person fails and they are known to like millions and millions of people all over the world, then that fail is a big fail because it will go on news cycles, it will go in everything, right? But let's say some team, right, in some small state, in some small rural area loses a playoff, like let's say it's a rural playoff or something. No one will even hear about it. No one will even care, right? Because again, that team was not placed on a pedestal where that fall was colossal, right? So again, always try to keep a low profile. I'm telling you this. Always try to keep a low profile. Kawhi Leonard keeps a low profile, but I feel like many other members of the LA Clippers, they just, a low profile was not a concept that they were familiar with, right? Because the thing is, it's better to keep a low profile. Don't come in as the person like, oh, like even if you're gifted in something, don't come in showing people that, oh, I'm the man in town, right? This is my city. This is my town. Or this is my area. I will dominate and destroy you here. No, don't make mouth because you never know. Someone that you don't know about can just come and just absolutely like obliterate you, right? So like as a med student, how will this apply to you, right? Like let's say, for example, you've done like a surgery rotation, right? Or let's say you have like some kind of life experience that makes you just particularly good at something. Let's say you're very good at surgery, or let's say you've been like a nurse before and you're now in med school or whatever, right? You don't have to lord it over your classmates that, oh, like, oh, I can suture this, I can do this, I can do that, I can do this, I can do that. No. You don't have to do any of those things, right? Go in humble, because again, it's the person that goes in humble that will learn. It's better to like come in, no one knows how good you are, and then you do good work and people are like, wow. The elevation you will get from that, from being an unlikely person that goes to a higher place, is better than from the person that, oh, came in boasting and everything. Even if the person does good work, right, you'll be like, yeah, you know, kind of par for the course. We know this person has been a nurse before. This person has done great work before, right? So they obviously are good at this thing, right? So again, basically on either end of the spectrum, whether like in a rise or in a fall, your rise is always higher when you're humble. And your fall is always softer when you're humble, right? So if you look at it again from both directions, that's a very logical argument there, right? Your rise is higher when you're humble and your fall is softer when you're humble. And usually people that are humble tend to rise more than they fall in life, right? So hopefully you find this lesson to be helpful. And I will see you in the next podcast. Thank you for listening to me. And again, if you want to sign up for any of these courses, just reach out to me through the website. Shoot me an email and then we'll kind of take things from there. So thank you for listening to me. God bless you. Have a wonderful weekend and I will see you next time. Thank you.